Welcome to Cancer Conference Update, ESMO Congress 2025. Today we're focusing on urothelial bladder cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Terrence Friedlander from the Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of California, San Francisco, in San Francisco, California. This is some data from the Niagara trial of perioperative durvalumab in muscle-invasive bladder cancer.
So this was a phase 3 study actually presented at ESMO as a plenary last year that looked at the value of giving durvalumab to cisplatin and gemcitabine as neoadjuvant therapy for muscle-invasive bladder cancer, and then giving durvalumab as adjuvant therapy in the treatment arm versus no adjuvant therapy. And so the study was positive last year. It really set up durvalumab cisgem as the standard of care for patients who have muscle-invasive disease. And this was a follow-on kind of looking at the sort of quality of life for patients who are getting this. And overall, I thought this was pretty straightforward study. We didn't really see any meaningful difference in quality of life scores for patients who were getting perioperative durvalumab. So, you know, we know durva is already a fairly well-tolerated therapy, just like almost all the PD-1s. And as you can see, if you look through the slides, you know, there's really the curves almost completely overlap when we look at the different pain scores, urologic symptom scores, et cetera. You know, I think this just lends further sort of support to using this regimen. You're not going to seriously decrease a patient's quality of life. I would love to see this done, not so much for this Niagara trial, but for the KEYNOTE-905 trial, which I'm sure will come up in a subsequent presentation, to really understand what the impact of EVP is in this space. Because if EVP really leads to a detriment in patients' quality of life, then maybe there's more room for people to get in this Niagara regimen of gemcitabine/durva. The challenge, obviously, is that KEYNOTE-905 trial showed such a dramatic difference in terms of EFS and OS that it's I still find it hard to find a good reason to use in that setting where we have both EVP as well as gemcitabine/durva to recommend giving gemcitabine/durva when the EVP data looks so strong.
How did you react to the Niagara data prior to seeing this new EV Pembro study? What were your thoughts about it?
Yeah, Niagara was an exciting study a year ago when it was presented because it was the first phase 3 trial in the perioperative setting, in the neoadjuvant setting, to be positive in about 15 or 20 years. So it really represented a first step forward by adding a checkpoint inhibitor to gem/cis and showing that there was clear benefits in terms of preventing relapses. So that was, I think, a good first step. I've used it now many times in the year, in the months since it's been approved here in the U.S. Remember the EVP study that we talked about earlier, that was only in the cisplatin ineligible population, and Niagara's in the cisplatin eligible population. So they're actually kind of mutually exclusive, more or less. So I think there's still a role for Niagara today if we're not able to give EVP for insurance reasons or whatnot, but there is a follow-on, study in the cisplatin eligible population. And if that study is of EVP, if that study is positive to the same magnitude that we've seen in other studies of EVP, I'm going to have a hard time figuring out who to give Niagara to. There's a lot of parallels with CheckMate 901 in the metastatic setting, which was a study of cisgem plus a PD-1 inhibitor. And even though that was a positive phase 3 trial, I haven't used that regimen very much because EVP is there and EVP is just so effective in controlling disease.
What about people with pre-existing significant neuropathies? Would you approach them differently?
Yeah, it's tricky. Neuropathy is really hard in bladder cancer, in oncology in general. One of the challenges for bladder is that both cisplatin can worsen neuropathy and enfortumab vedotin can worsen neuropathy. So, I've been asked a few times, like, who is the patient who's eligible for, not eligible for EV, but eligible for cisplatin? And the answer is there are not a lot of those patients. You know, bad diabetes is also a contraindication to getting EV, a hemoglobin A1C above 8. You shouldn't be giving those patients EV or random blood sugar above 250. They shouldn't get it on that day because there's been serious hyperglycemic events associated with EV. But, you know, truthfully, it's hard to give cisplatin to someone with really poorly controlled diabetes because you have to use a lot of steroids to control the nausea and vomiting. So there's not really a clean patient population to give cisgem to when they're not eligible for EV.
So let's talk about HER2-targeted ADCs, beginning with a very impressive report of first-line treatment of metastatic disease with dasatamab vedotin plus the PD-1 agent teriflunomab. What is DV?
So DV, or dasatamab vedotin, is an antibody-drug conjugate, very much like EV. It has the same payload, MMAE. It just targets HER2. And in this ESMO study, this was a phase 3 trial done entirely in China using toripalimab, which is a PD-1 agent approved there. And that was compared to chemotherapy in the frontline setting. That was a very positive study. We actually, when we look at the data, we see the outcome measures are almost remarkably similar to what we saw with EV and pembrolizumab in the frontline setting. Like the hazard ratios were almost identical. Median OS was about 2 years. Median PFS was on the order of 12 months or so. As we can see in the schema, it was a very straightforward study, you know, comparing these two arms of DV, toripalimab to cisgem. There was a doubling of the median PFS. Hazard ratio here was 0.36, which is really impressive, and that's very similar to what we saw in EV-302. So clearly MMAE is valuable. And then the OS hazard ratio was 0.45, and again, with an almost a doubling of the median OS. And the duration of response looked great, very significant benefit. When patients start responding, you know, they do eventually progress, but about 20 or 30% of them probably have long-term durable responses lasting, you know, many years. And that's great to see. It's great to see it with DV. In terms of toxicity, you know, the adverse event profile is quite similar in many respects to EV, with neuropathy being an issue. Some are a little different. There's more liver toxicity here, probably because of the expression of HER2 is different than the expression of Nectin-4. And some other GI side effects. Neuropathy was about the same as we saw with both drugs. There is a randomized phase 3 trial of dasatamab vedotin plus pembrolizumab. That's a worldwide phase 3 trial that we're waiting for results on. I think what's important from this study of HER2 is that this study allowed patients with HER2 1+, 2+, and 3+ in. And there was a sub-analysis that actually showed that the HER2 1+ patients responded pretty well, much better than we've seen with the exception of T-DXd from HER2 targeting agents in the past. And so that really raises the question of, like, how much HER2 antigen is needed when we're giving an ADC, especially this MMAE-containing ADC. Because if it's applicable to, you know, a much broader population, you know, HER2 3+ probably is only like maybe 15 or 20% of all bladder cancer patients, whereas HER2 1+ and higher is probably more than half of patients. So I think there's still some unanswered questions about, like, how much HER2 is needed. You know, with T-DXd, we've seen in breast cancer that, you know, ultra low HER2 is still responding. So maybe that'll be the case with dasatamab vedotin. What I think is kind of interesting about DV and its development is that it is being positioned in the frontline space. So DV pembro as your frontline regimen. And in the phase 3, it's being compared to cisplatin and gemcitabine. But we already have a frontline antibody drug conjugate containing MMAE called EV and pembro. And so if the DV study is positive, we're suddenly going to have two very similar drugs targeting different antigens that have kind of similar effects, at least if this data holds. And I think it's going to be very hard to know who to give EV to and who to give DV. Obviously, if there's zero HER2 expression, we give EV. If there's 3+, maybe we'll give DV. But, you know, what to do for the 1+ and 2+, I think is really not well known. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I think these trials also have trouble with accrual worldwide because EV has become such a standard of care. Now it's harder to randomize people to cisgem when that's really no longer the standard of care in many countries. And so I think that just makes it challenging to find patients who are willing to undergo a randomization to cisplatin gemcitabine.
It sounds like you're saying there's not any data or a lot of data in the recurrent situation with dasatamab vedotin DV, the way it is with T-DXd?
Yeah, so it's been looked
single
at.
Single agent?
post-platinum, exactly, a single agent, which is exactly the way Eevee was developed. And it's very effective in that space, too. It looks kind of, my, you know, very kind of bird's eye view, very similar to Eevee, not identical. The challenge is that we don't really have studies of patients who got Eevee followed by DV. And I worry about the neuropathy. I told you about half of patients will dose reduce or stop drug due to neuropathy. And so we'll have to see in this, either this trial or other trials, if there are patients who've gotten EV after DV or the other way around, how many patients can really tolerate going from one to the other. And actually, on a much deeper level, like, what is the resistance mechanism to these ADCs with MMAE? Is it the target that goes away, or is it the payload that the cells get resistant to? Because if they're resistant to MMAE, then it doesn't make sense to retreat them with a different ADC containing MMAE. And so we've generated some data here at UCSF. John Chow, my colleague and friend, has published this, saying that perhaps it's the payload. This is early days cell line data, you know, in the lab, so we don't really know. But I think that it raises a sort of a conundrum, and I don't really know. I think we just have to see how the studies look and go from there.
So one other thing, and I hear this a lot, once I get outside of breast cancer, when people talk about HER2-1 or 2+, a lot of, you know, in breast cancer, HER2-low is defined as 1 or 2+, but FISH negative or mm-hmm. ISH negative. But a lot of times outside of breast cancer, I don't see that. So when you say 1+, I'm assuming they don't know the FISH.
Yeah, a lot of times either we don't have it or the FISH is known. And if they're FISH positive, I think that just allows them in the trial. So I don't think we've done nearly the amount of work that our colleagues in breast cancer have done to really define, like, even just the rates of 1+, 2+, 3+ by IHC. Like, there's about 10 different papers, and they all quote slightly different numbers. So I think in bladder, we're, even though we've known that HER2 has been a target for many years, there was a study of TDM1, there was a study of lapatinib, there have been some studies of adding trastuzumab, the antibody. We've not really, you know, seen a major hit, and it's sort of being rediscovered now. And that actually brings us to the Destiny Pan tumor study. This was a really important study because it looked at giving TDXD to a wide number of malignancies that have some HER2 expression, including women's cancers, bladder, and then pancreas and biliary tract. And based on the initial bladder numbers, and this was updated at ESMO this year, you know, this generated an FDA approval. We saw that the HER2 3+ patients had a 56% response rate to TDXD, which was, you know, high, especially in a late line setting. You know, if we compare this to taxanes, the overall response rate's like 10 to 20%. And so this generated and then just in terms of the follow up, they looked at, you know, the HER2 status by different groups and basically looked at longer term outcomes like PFS. We saw about a 7-month PFS, which is pretty similar, maybe a little underwhelming. Excuse me, the PFS was, depending on how much HER2 there was, it was higher, like 3+ was 13% compared to low. But this was good, not as good as what we saw in endometrial, cervical, or ovarian cancer, where PFS was a lot longer. But, you know, bladder cancer patients tend to be older, frailer, sicker, more comorbidities, so maybe they can't tolerate as much drug. So there's a lot of confounders in there, so I'd be careful about comparing the different tumor types to each other. It was enough to say that, like, you know, with taxanes in late line setting, we don't see, you know, year plus PFS. You know, even if you saw year plus survival, that would be a you know, surprising. So this clearly has a role in late line bladder cancer TDXD. I've used it now in many patients. I think we're still trying to sort of wrap our heads around it and understand, should we be giving this earlier? And that's where the DV studies are important, and sort of see where this goes. But certainly it like supports the data we already know about TDXD and says, yes, this is a good choice for patients who have HER2 high bladder cancer. You know, 3+ is the current FDA approval. Although I've personally used it in 2+ patients and, you know, for what it's worth, anecdotally seen benefit.
Any comments on tolerability? One thing, again, I like to ask once I get outside of breast cancer is what you've observed with acute GI toxicity, how much of an issue that's been with these particular patients.
Yeah, I don't think it's been that.
Observations on ILD either.
Yeah, I personally, I've used it in a number of patients, not like hundreds, or not even dozens for that matter. So it's a little hard to say. I mean, from my experience, has been like sort of as billed. There's, you know, some GI tox, we give them loperamide. I've yet to fortunately experience a patient who had like a grade 3 diarrhea. There is a risk for ILD with TDXD that's well reported. I fortunately haven't seen it. I've seen it with other agents. You know, on trial, we had patients who developed lung toxicity from EV. That's well described. It's maybe 10% of patients, maybe a little higher depending on what report you use. So I think we have to be careful. And the other piece is with advanced bladder cancer, because this is patients who've had, most of the patients I'm using TDXD in have already had platinum, they've already had EV and Pembro, so they're kind of in a late line setting. And that strangely selects for either patients who are incredibly sick, who then, you know, don't tolerate this that well, or patients who have kind of slow disease that's sort of slowly progressive and can handle this. And they in my experience, have done okay. I think there's like value in bladder cancer for these other agents like TDXD and others in like patients who have variant subtypes of bladder cancer who tend not to respond well to platinum. But if they have HER2, I've seen decent responses. I've also seen that with sacituzumab govitecan, which is a TROP2 targeting TCAN containing ADC. No longer available in bladder cancer, but I've seen that. So, I think it's great to see this sort of expanding into bladder cancer. And I don't know if there's going to be an earlier role for TDXD as a frontline therapy, you know, but we'll see that with DB.
Of course, that's happening in breast cancer, particularly as of ASCO, it became first line.
Right.
And one other thing that I just heard about recently, maybe I'm the last person to hear this, but I was totally shocked. Which is, I had a session last week with John Haymock from MD Anderson's lung cancer program, and he told me about HER2 TKD mutations. HER2 mutations in lung cancer, which has been treated with TDXD, even first line, they have pretty good responses. But it turns out that most of these HER2 mutations are HER2 TKD. In other words, the mutations in the kinase, and there are two TKIs that have like a 75% response rate. And they're non-smokers.
Interesting.
Sound familiar?
Yeah, so it this sounds is like, just the like new, our EGFR story.
The reason I'm bringing that up is I said, well, what about breast cancer and all these other cancers? And he goes, they're in there. You just have to look. They're very, very rare, but they respond. And he predicted that these new TKIs, one of them is approved already, are going to be pan-tumor.
It'd be great. You know, I've seen HER2 mutations actually not infrequently in bladder cancer, and we never quite knew what to do with them. I've treated like a handful of patients with lapatinib, neratinib, but I haven't seen great responses. But again, these were like very late line, kind of frail, sick patients. And maybe if we do it in a more organized, prospective manner, and, you know, have good performance status, you know, depending on what the side effect profile of these agents are, you know, there could be some value into that, you know. So.
Zongertinib. It was approved this summer. So you were talking about sacituzumab, which at one point I was bragging that you guys had all the ADCs earlier on, because sacituzumab was approved at one point.
Yeah.
But anyhow, in terms of TROP2, Dato-DXd plus rilvegostomib.
Yeah.
Was presented. First of all, what about Dato-DXd and urothelial bladder, and what about this combination?
So this is a pan-tumor study, and this was just one of the arms looking at Dato-DXd, which is a TROP2 targeting ADC that has a TCAN payload, and basically adding that to a immunotherapy, which is a PD-1 TIGIT targeting immunotherapy, a bispecific. And so this is interesting. The study is super small. It's only 22 patients in the front line, 18 patients in the second line. They saw responses in just about every patient. I think there was one patient who had PD in the front line, and then the responses were a little less in the second line. So that was exciting. I think in terms of the adverse event profiles, sort of what we'd expect for Dato-DXd or sacituzumab govitecan with, you know, GI, sort of some risk for infections and, oral sores and things like that. Immune side effects didn't seem to be that high with this agent. Of course, it wasn't really compared to non-immunotherapy. But enough to say that, okay, there were some interesting, you know, good responses here. I don't really know where Trope 2 sits in the armamentarium. You know, the TROPiCS-04 trial, which was the phase 3 trial of sacituzumab govitecan versus taxane investigator's choice chemotherapy, was a negative study that was presented last year at ESMO Asia. I was actually the discussant for that. My friend Petros Grievas presented it. The study was negative, but a lot of patients had serious toxicity, neutropenic fever, and neutropenic death in the very first cycle. I think it was like on the order of 15 or 16 patients died of neutropenic fevers, which was like 5% of the treatment arm. Yeah. And they'd actually amended the study about halfway through to allow but not require GCSF. And, you know, it's easy to play armchair quarterback and say, oh, if they just given, you know, GCSF to everyone, maybe the study would have been positive. I'm not so certain. I don't think that the Trope 2 targeting ADCs are necessarily as strong or as powerful based on single arm studies as EV is, but as either an add-on where we have dual antibody drug, you know, at the same time, that data was actually presented as well, that looked decent, or as a later line therapy, and this is where this tropion pan tumor, you know, data may be relevant, to say, all right, maybe we give EVP up front, and then we give a second line therapy with a different target, different payload, and see if we can get benefit and just make sure that the GCSF is given. You know, the contribution here of the TIGIT has unfortunately not done well or not performed well across most of oncology and lung cancer. There was a negative study. I was an investigator on the Morpheus trial in bladder cancer where we looked at TIGIT and the data was underwhelming. And so I think we're still sort of jury's still out on what the value of TIGIT is here. But, you know, adding PD-1, maybe not a surprise. I'm not super confident that giving PD-1 after PD-1 in bladder cancer is going to yield really any value. We know it does not in two randomized phase 3 trials in kidney cancer. So it's hard to see like where this combination goes. I'd love to see, you know, more data about Dato-DXd, either as monotherapy. There's actually a phase 3 trial of Dato-DXd plus cisgem versus cisgem in the second line settings after EVP. And I think that's quite a cool study. We're going to open it here at UCSF soon. And so maybe there's a role for giving these agents monotherapy, giving it with platinum, you know, and sort of trying to fit it into the second line space. So hopefully that study accrues well and is positive, and then we'll have, you know, access to another Trop-2 targeting agent in bladder cancer.
So I will say, you know, because sacituzumab sort of died out there in urothelial bladder, you guys never got really a chance to use it a lot. But in breast cancer, sacituzumab and Dato are both approved.
Right.
And actually, even though they both target Trop-2, they have different tolerability issues. You do not see much cytopenias with Dato. You see a lot with Sassy, a lot of dose holds from cytopenias, neutropenia. You don't see that in Dato. What you do see, particularly if they don't use the preemptive mouthwash, is a lot of mucositis. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Friedlander, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Cancer Conference Update.